This week on Texas Scorecard Radio, a top state lawmaker busted with cocaine. We'll talk about the fallout from that. We'll also drop in on Montgomery County, where an effort to clean up local government is predictably being subsumed by cronyism. In our interview, we'll get some facts in the face of the celebrity and media-driven frenzy over the scheduled execution of Rodney Reed. And finally, whose side are you on? Empower Texans CEO Michael Quinn Sullivan will discuss that question in this week's Texas Scorecard Radio commentary. Welcome back, friends, to this week's episode of Texas Scorecard Radio. I'm your host, Tony McDonald, coming to you from the 1836 studios in Austin, Texas. You can find us on the web at www.texasscorecard.com. Wanted to get started with this week's top news. I've got Brandon Waltons, managing editor for Texas Scorecard.
Howdy.
Big story this week, top lawmaker in the Texas House of Representatives busted for cocaine possession. Yeah. Not just, you know, okay, guy gets busted, goes jail, mugshot, all that. There's some, you know, serious and interesting political implications to the story. So tell us what's going on.
Never a dull moment, it seems, right?
Yeah, yeah.
In the Texas legislature, I think you could, write a soap opera or TV show about it.
They've talked about doing that in the past. I'm not sure if it'll ever come to fruition.
Who knows? I mean, this story goes back. Okay. This story starts in September, September 6th specifically. You've got a state representative, a Democrat from kind of South Texas, a guy by the name of Pancho Navarez. This is a Democrat chairman appointed by Speaker Dennis Bonin. He heads up the Homeland Security and Public Safety Committee. That'll come into play later. But he's flying into the Austin airport on a Friday and gets in his car. Well, it turns out you've got DPS officers and TxDOT people notice that he's dropped an envelope, that there's an envelope dropped full of cocaine, four bags of cocaine, and it has his name on it. It's the office of state representative.
Literally his official state envelope with his name and office address right on it, packed full of cocaine, dropped on the ground at this state airport facility as he's coming into town. This story kind of sits under the, you know, under the visibility line. No one knew about it for a couple months.
And that's what's really interesting, right? Because even though you've got a DPS affidavit to this, you've got all the evidence, you have Pancho essentially admitting it after the story comes out, you have absolutely no action. He's not arrested.
So let's backtrack. So what we learned, this is last week, our friends over at Direct Action Texas get their hands on the search warrant, the search warrant affidavit, all of that information, which tells the entire saga about this cocaine bust. There had been briefly some rumors about that kind of earlier in the day that were, you know, I think we were reporting on a little bit, but we had seen him. He had resigned about a week, or announced abruptly that he was retiring from the legislature about a week before this. So that everybody was kind of confused.
Yes.
Why is this guy dropping out?
Yeah, not just announcing that he was retiring, but he also said, he was deleting his Facebook immediately in protest of Mark Zuckerberg and his conservative policies, I guess. I don't know. A very, very odd statement. I think everybody saw, when you're following the legislature and politics in general, right, you tend to maybe be a little bit more cynical reading between the lines on these sort of statements, and it seemed, okay, there's probably more to this story.
Well, there's indeed some kind of scandal, and indeed there was.
Yeah, indeed this comes out. Well, it comes out. Immediately he tells the media, yes, that was me. That was my cocaine. Kind of hard to deny given the facts of the situation.
Got his name on it.
And then shortly after, there is an arrest warrant put out. He turns himself in, is out on bond. And so now he's being charged with a felony, with felony possession. And it's really, really putting Speaker Dennis Bonin, who we've talked quite a bit about, who's on his way out, it's putting him in an interesting situation too.
Yeah, so first of all, this guy is a Democrat chairman. I mean, people maybe don't pay attention to realize that in the Texas House of Representatives, lots of Democrats given lots of authority and positions of power.
Yeah,
this has been
50-50.
A problem for a long time. this guy is the chairman of the committee with authority over border security,
yes,
and law enforcement.
Yeah, and specifically as well, the Department of Public Safety, the very people who filed this affidavit search warrant
busted him with the cocaine. So a couple of members reaching out to Speaker Bonin with a letter saying, hey, can you remove this guy? Can we get rid of this guy? He shouldn't be shouldn't be the chairman of the police committee.
Right. And from a political perspective purely, I mean, these are a few Republican chairmen. You get Jeff Leach, James White, Phil King saying, maybe we should, would you please remove this guy at least as chair of the committee, if not from the committees entirely. From a political perspective, should be a slam dunk for Republican, especially for Speaker Dennis Bonin, who is retiring after a scandal of his own. We won't get into all that, but he's retiring. He's on his way out after his situation. Should be an easy opportunity. Well, Dennis Bonin fires back almost immediately, replies to this letter and says, sorry, my hands are tied. I don't have the power to remove a committee chair, which at first you see me citing rules.
There was some legal mumbo jumbo that, you know, maybe this is accurate.
Is that true? I don't know. You look at it, you go look at those rules and you know, you'd have to take a very, very narrow, a very specific interpretation,
which speakers don't do. It's very interesting that he's going out of his way to say, well, I just can't do anything about this, you know, cocaine possession charge, police committee chairman. Mm-hmm. I can't do anything. It makes you wonder, like, what else is going on here that these people are not willing to take action against each other?
And it's very interesting. And I think it's just one other thing. You know, we've talked pretty much since the session ended that you've seen this movement start to build up with grassroots conservatives wanting a special session. I think this is another opportunity where they're saying, hey, lawmakers need to come back and they need to get their affairs in order.
Yeah. Well, and notably, Bonin's answer, he says, well, a new speaker could replace. Yeah. So it's like, okay, all right, well, let's get rid of you. You know, you're already on the way out as a scandal. Anyway, something to keep an eye on, whether we'll be able to get rid of this guy, whether there's more scandal to unfold. Very interesting. Keep an eye on. Thanks for your reporting.
Yes, always something.
Next, let's turn and talk to Reagan Reed down in Montgomery County. Reagan, you've been covering the issues in Montgomery County with ethics, the lack of ethics, obviously some lack of transparency and corruption that's gone on with the past government there in Montgomery County. And during the legislative session, there was this effort to pass a bill to allow Montgomery County to create an ethics commission, which was billed as a way to clean this up. And I had a lot of concerns at the time that this would not work out well. And now you're reporting that it's not appearing to be working out very well. Tell us what's going on there.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And the Ethics Commission, it was well-intentioned, I believe, but it's turning out to be much worse in practice than it was in theory.
Yeah, so this is a commission created, authorized by law, that would be a, you know, unfortunately, kind of a closed door process, behind backroom process, but it's supposed to be a toothful process to actually hold local elected officials accountable when they breach the ethics code. So do things that are not transparent or involve conflicts of interest, those sorts of things.
Right, and we have had lots of trouble with corruption and conflicts of interest in this county. The problem now is that after the commissioners have made their appointments, we find out that the people who are going to be on this committee responsible for holding the commissioners accountable actually have worked for the commissioners.
Yeah, so walk us through some of these appointments as examples of what's going on.
Okay, so to start it off, appointment made by County Judge Mark Keough is his former administrative assistant, Amanda Whittington, who worked for him as recently as this year. And so there's not a lot of lack of distance there. Probably the worst one is the appointment made by Precinct 4 Commissioner James Metz. He appointed a man who actually was his chief of staff. and worked for the county as recently as August of this year.
So we're literally taking staff who work for the people who are supposed to be held accountable, and then other, you know, county employees and bureaucrats, they're the ones who are being put in there and being told, hey, you're supposed to police your bosses in their ethics.
Yeah, and they're taking employees even from other governments. You know, for example, Precinct 1 Commissioner Mike Metter appointed Nancy McKeska, the Community Development Director for the City of Conroe. Charlie Riley, the Precinct 2 Commissioner, appointed former City Councilwoman, who's on one of these economic zoning boards or whatever now. So, I mean, the whole thing just stinks.
Yeah, well, it's kind of what I expected, but something that we'll definitely have to keep an eye on to see how bad it turns out, but certainly not looking good moving forward. Thank you for reporting on it, Reagan.
You bet.
Texas Scorecard Radio is a project of Empower Texans. At texasscorecard.com or empowertexans.com, you can find more news and daily updates from all around the Lone Star State. You can also find updates from Empower Texans and Texas Scorecard on Facebook and Twitter, and follow Empower Texans on Instagram. Texas Scorecard's News Digest goes out weekly via email and monthly in print. Subscribe online and find more information at empowertexans.com. Someone's always keeping score. We think it ought to be the taxpayers.
Well, it's great to welcome on the program this week, Matt Beebe. Matt, you've been doing a lot of writing about this story that is, you know, boiling across the media and in the state, the scheduled execution of Rodney Reed for a 1996 murder. And there's this celebrity movement going, saying, oh, my gosh, this is an innocent man who's on death row. And you've been out there writing about it, saying, hold up. This is not exactly accurate. Thanks for coming on and shedding a little light on it for us.
Absolutely, Tony. It's good to be with you. Well, actually, what was the scheduled execution date? Of course, we are past that now.
That's right.
Because a lot of these activities that we're going to talk about here in a minute have really swayed not only public opinion, but swayed the opinion of people in leadership positions and in both political and justice side of things that have kind of switched up the script.
So, yeah, that's right. So the execution was scheduled to take place this week, and we saw just a few days back you had the Court of Criminal Appeals issue a stay. Ultimately, that delays the execution as further appellate proceedings take place. You also had the Board of Pardons and Parole recommend to Governor Greg Abbott to put a stay on the execution. Of course, that was unnecessary because of the action of the Court of Criminal Appeals. But you've seen this boiling out there. Obviously, not just celebrities. You know, Oprah and Kim Kardashian and Beyonce out there all saying this is a horrible outrage and somebody must do something. But you've seen a bipartisan group of legislators, Texas state representatives, and I think some other leaders who have come forward with letters to Governor Abbott saying, hey, we've got to stop this execution, because it looks like this guy is innocent, and bold claims out there of actual innocence. And you've been writing about it saying, whoa, there's a lot of there's no real reason to believe that there is actual innocence here.
Yeah, so the question here is kind of an interesting one from a political observer standpoint and a social commentary standpoint, just to the extent to which this group that really is an anti-death penalty group. Let's be clear about that. They're not a Free Rodney group. They're an anti-death penalty group. And so this is the latest case with which they're seeking to advance their underlying cause in the court of public opinion. And this case happens to be really a fascinating case in a lot of ways because of how successful they've been in manipulating the truth around this case.
Yeah, so let's talk about, for people who maybe don't know what's going on, what happened in 1996 with the murder?
Yeah, so let's go to what are sort of the agreed upon facts, and I tried in the article to be very balanced in presenting this, and certainly the listeners probably should. Hopefully, we'll give them a link to that later in the conversation.
Sure.
But up at the Federalist,
yeah. A great article, kind of lining these things out up at the Federalist by Matt Beebe, our guest. So anyway, sorry, go ahead.
No, thank you. Yeah. So what we know, really sort of undisputed, is in April of 1996, a young 19-year-old woman who had been engaged to be married to her law enforcement fiancé left to go to work in early morning hours. She worked the night shift at HEB. She was found murdered the next day, raped and murdered, along the side of the road in Bastrop County. There were a host of things that, when we look back at it with a modern lens, we might say could have been done a little bit differently. But there was no question that she was killed, that she had DNA evidence from somebody else other than her fiancé in and on her. And an investigation, of course, ensued. And they spent about 6 months with really very little to go on in the case. Of course, the fiancé, you know, the closest person to her, is always a suspect from a get in those types of investigations. They investigated that. They found that his DNA, it was not his DNA material that was on her, so they cleared him in that regard. They had, I think, 24 other potential suspects that had been identified during that time period of the first 6-7 months of the investigation who were also cleared from DNA testing. Then this gentleman, Rodney Reed, ends up getting picked up after being accused and subsequently identified by the potential victim, but accused of a kidnapping and attempted assault by a young woman in a similar circumstance to the way that Stacy Stites, the victim in this case, had been found.
Yeah, so this is six months after Stacy Stites is raped and murdered. Another woman in approximately the same area, same time frame, is confronted, and it's basically an attempted rape assault, potentially a murder that is going down. It does not happen, but this woman is able to identify the culprit as Rodney Reed.
Right, absolutely. And so, and we, let's be as generous as possible. We have no idea what he was going to do with that young woman, but God bless the fact that she was able to escape.
Right.
Now, when that was reported, though, the law enforcement officers were like, well, that seems interesting, right? It's very similar circumstances to the way that they believed that Stacy had been abducted and subsequently raped and murdered. Well, it just so happens this guy was known to the law enforcement team because he had been accused of raping and assaulting another woman. In this case, his quote unquote girlfriend, who happened to be disabled, and they had DNA evidence from that reported rape that was not really disputed as his, because he had claimed that they had a quote unquote girlfriend relationship, so they had an ongoing relationship. So they used the DNA in that case that had been legally collected and had a match. And so now suddenly they have a lead suspect in the murder of Stacy Stites. It seems at the get, it's reasonably straightforward, and so they pull him in, interview him. He denies knowing her. I don't know anything about this woman.
To be clear,
to be clear,
he's confronted about it, and he says, "I don't know this Stacy Stites woman. Doesn't know who she is.
Never met her. Never talked to her. No idea who she is." Then, of course, they're like, well, just so happens that your DNA was in and on her. Can you explain that, right? We've all seen that sort of thing with the suspect in the box in a crime drama, right? Well, of course, just like the suspects in a crime drama do, he said, oh, yeah, well, we had a relationship. We had a consensual relationship. We were dating. It was secret. We didn't tell anybody about it. And that's why, I didn't tell you about it either right now, even though you're suspecting me in her rape and murder. I was going to just kind of not tell you that until you sort of told me you'd have DNA evidence.
Well, and to be clear, you know, people could lie about this sort of thing and then change their story around. But you have a character here not just fingered for this one crime, but a whole series of rapes and sexual assaults.
Right. And let's talk about that for a moment here in the context of the media coverage, right? So if you were just an ordinary person, like most of your listeners are, most people are, and you're not paying attention deeply into these kind of events, and you're just sort of getting some of the drive-by coverage of it, you think this guy is somebody who was picked up, set up, in fact, because there's some, we can talk about in a second, her fiancé turned out to be a rotten person as well. A couple years later, he gets picked up and serves time, or convicted and serves time for the assault of a woman in his custody when he was a police officer. So he turns out to be a bad actor as well.
Sure.
Just because you're a bad actor doesn't mean everything bad was committed by you, obviously, right? But you probably don't realize that he had at least three or four other rape assault allegations. They were indictments that went forward. If they're trying to be honest in their reporting, they will put this little codicil in there that says never convicted, which of course sows doubt in your mind. Well, he was never convicted of those. He's been wrongly accused before. Well, no. When you go up for the death penalty, they're going to go and make sure that they, you know, kind of hit that ball out of the park from a prosecutorial standpoint.
Yeah,
other stuff sort of gets suspended. So what you have here is
the critics, who are the anti-death penalty critics, latching onto this case, and they're trying to paint it as here's this black man in Bastrop County who is having a secret affair with a white woman. Whose white police officer, fiance, finds out about it, murders her, and, falsely accuses this innocent guy who's only engaged, his crime and transgression was engaging in this secret interracial affair. I mean, that's basically the story as it is sold. But when you dig into it, you find out, well, hold on, wait a second. This guy who's accused of it is implicated in 3, 4, 5, 6 different rapes, a whole series of assaults on women, and some that are eerily similar to the crime in question that he was convicted for.
Absolutely. And there's really, I don't think there's any question in anybody's mind that has looked at this case that Rodney Reed is a bad dude. There's a different narrative, certainly, that's being presented by his advocates as this, innocent guy. But there's really zero evidence to suggest now, that this is a church choir sort of character.
Now, one of the things that the critics have been asking for is they say, look, there were flaws in the trial, and so we need to go back. We need to retest evidence. We need to represent evidence. We need, the expert testimony. I even see this in articles where they just flat out falsely say, "Oh, well, the evidence makes it impossible that Reed could have committed the crime," which is completely false. You've literally have some backtracking on scientific testimony about the evidence. But they're basically saying, look, we need to just do this as a do-over because of procedural reasons. That doesn't really hold water when you dig into it, though.
Right, absolutely. And so you'll see there was one of the articles claimed, as you said, that it was impossible. Of course, and even the advocate's expert testimony didn't even say it was impossible. They stopped short of that because they have at least apparently some sense of their professional reputations. But as it gets twisted by celebrities and media and reporters in this case, you kind of lose some of that fidelity to the truth. to put it lightly, let's say. But let's talk about that. So there's this claim that there's new DNA evidence that is being refused to be tested, right? Well, first off, there's no new DNA evidence. All of the evidence is, nobody's claiming there's anything new. What there is a new testing technique you probably might have heard about it, touch DNA. It's a much more sophisticated way to test items to see if there's any other DNA left on them. It's a lot more sensitive than it was 20 years ago. Now, here's the dilemma. There's a belt, which is presumed to be the murder weapon, and she had a back brace with her that was kind of thrown in the back of the truck. Both of those items were not collected and preserved in a way that would be consistent with this touch DNA testing. So let me say that again.
Well, and my understanding is, my understanding is they were presented at the, they were handled in the course of the trial. Even here's the belt, here's the evidence, and those things would introduce foreign DNA of all the people involved in the trial process.
Absolutely. So there's a chain of custody, that wasn't kept, and it wasn't. There's been no allegation that there was any ill intent in this. It was just how things were done 20 years ago, because nobody thought you could actually get testable DNA off of these types of items. So it wasn't preserved. It was handled, and it was handled at trial. And there's even some question, even some of the jurors may have even handled it during the trial. So the idea that testing this would show anything other than confusion is just a fantasy of the advocate and their misrepresentation.
Basically, these people saying, oh, here, let's create this narrative. Oh, well, all we're asking for is a simple thing to test it, which seems very reasonable. But then that's going to just introduce, all of the jurors as potential suspects or something along those lines. All right, well, we're running out of time. I would encourage listeners, go check out Matt Beebe's article at The Federalist. Walks through all of this. You can read, unfortunately, some of the gory details of the allegations against Rodney Reed, but it's a good injection of truth into a debate that is, being carried on by folks who, just aren't necessarily interested in the truth. They're interested in advancing an agenda. And if you want to avoid being hoodwinked, it's a great way to check that out. Thanks for coming on the program, Matt.
Hey, appreciate it. Thanks, Tony.
It's that time of year again. Time for Empower Texans' annual Conservative Leaders Gala. The Conservative Leaders Gala, or CLG, happens each December in Irving, Texas, and is a time for celebration and fellowship with members of the grassroots from the far reaches of the Lone Star State. One night where we all come together and honor the hard work done by everyday Texans to ensure Texas Lone Star shines a little brighter. As we've done every year, 12 awesome activists will be honored in front of the crowd and be awarded engraved cavalry swords, symbolizing their role on the front lines of the fight for freedom. So RSVP today at empowertexans.com/events and join us at the Conservative Leaders Gala December 7th in Irving, Texas.
Whose side are you on? Empower Texans CEO Michael Quinn Sullivan touches on that in this week's commentary.
William Travis famously drew a line in the sand, asking his fellow Alamo defenders to join him in putting their lives on the line for liberty in the Lone Star State. With this week's Texas Scorecard Radio commentary, I'm Michael Quinn Sullivan. When it comes to choosing a side in an important debate, most politicians prefer to hang back and see where the crowd's going before they'll pick a side. Unlike Travis, they want to be on the safe side of every side. The politicians don't say that, of course. They say they're being judicious, thoughtful, deliberative, and diligent. Hogwash. What they're most often doing is waiting to see where the majority will land and calculating the latest point to which they can pick a side in service to their personal ambitions. I want to take you back a couple thousand years and 7,000 miles to the plains of Jericho, where a pivotal question about sides took place. After crossing the Jordan River, the Israelites camped on those plains in preparation for God's command that they march on the highly fortified city of Jericho. Joshua, who had only recently taken over as the Israelites' commander, was confronted with a mighty warrior. That he was fearsome inside is not in question. Was this simply an angelic being, or, as many theologians will argue, a pre-incarnate visit by the Son of God? Either way, Joshua decided he better be on the right side of this guy. So Joshua asks the ultimate, whose side are you on anyway, question. Are you for us or for our adversaries? He asked. Seems like the right question before a big fight, right? The response probably isn't what Joshua was expecting. Quote, no, but I am the commander of the army of the Lord. Now I have come, end quote. That answer should ring in our ears as loudly as it did for Joshua. It doesn't matter if someone is on our side or if we're on their side. The only question that counts, are we on God's side? It's a question we should daily and prayerfully consider. I'm Michael Quinn Sullivan with this week's Texas Scorecard Radio Commentary.
Well, that's all I've got for you. Come back next week and also go register for the Conservative Leaders Gala. I want to see all of your bright, shining faces in Irving on December 7th. You can register for that event at empowertexans.com/events. Thanks.
Texas Scorecard Radio is brought to you each week as a public service from the Empower Texans Foundation and in partnership with the Lincoln Institute and this station. You can download podcasts from each program and learn more at empowertexans.com.